This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Bob Deans. He's Director of Strategic Engagement with the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. And we are here today to talk about the Paris climate talks, what happened, what we can look forward to in the new year and in the coming years. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte. Great to be with you.
Now, you were there. How did this talk differ from all the other climate talks we've had in the past, which honestly don't seem to have resulted in real overall reductions in greenhouse gas emissions?
I guess, Mary Charlotte, the best way would be compare it to Copenhagen in 2009. I was at those talks as well. I think a couple of things. One, there was a sense of urgency about these talks in Paris. You know, a lot's happened in the past 5 to 6 years that has solidified the sense that we're facing a real problem globally. We just had last year, 2014, was the hottest year on record. This year, 2015, has been even hotter still. And 19 of the hottest years ever recorded, Mary Charlotte, have all occurred in the last 20 years. So people are actually seeing the impact of rising seas, widening deserts, withering drought, blistering heat, raging wildfires, storms and floods. And so there was this sense of urgency. Number two, the biggest country, the biggest part of the carbon pollution problem right now, China, recognizes it is facing an existential threat from pollution associated with burning fossil fuels. And so China was coming there saying, in our own interest, we must do something about this, and the United States as well. So you had the two largest emitters in the world saying, we're putting real plans on the table, and that galvanized a global sentiment where we had 187 countries, imagine that, 187 countries all put on the table their own plans for reducing the dangerous carbon emissions that are driving global climate change. And what that means is everybody is looking to do three things. Invest in efficiency, so we cut down on energy waste, because that's the quickest, cheapest way to cut carbon pollution. Number two, build modern transportation systems that give folks real options. And number three, get more clean power from sources like the wind and the sun. There's a global commitment to move every country in that direction.
So those were the methods of greenhouse gas reductions most talked about, renewable sources like solar and wind and efficiency. Were there any other methods discussed?
Certainly, always a big topic is forest restoration and preservation, because the forests of the world are, you've heard of the rainforest being described as the lungs of the world, but the forests of the world also are a huge carbon tank, what's called a carbon sink. Trees absorb carbon dioxide from the air. And so when we preserve forest in Papua New Guinea, in Indonesia, in Brazil, in across Africa, when we preserve those forests, then we are helping to pull carbon dioxide out of the air and reduce those greenhouse gases. When, on the other hand, those forests are destroyed for agricultural purposes or for development, they release carbon into the atmosphere, and that is exacerbating the problem. So once you start dealing with fossil fuels, the second thing is to deal with deforestation. And the third thing, which is really big, is to deal with agriculture, because agriculture uses a lot of energy. Livestock production produces a lot of methane, which is a greenhouse gas that's many times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And so those are big parts of the problem, and they have to be big parts of the solution.
There are methods of carbon sequestration, like storing carbon in the soil. We talk about forests. We could also talk about agriculture within that respect. There's also sometimes high-tech methods of carbon sequestration that are discussed that seem a little odd. Was that part of the conversation?
It is a part of the side conversation, and it's a growing part of the solution, and we're seeing it in some places in this country, for example, in Mississippi, the Southern Company is building a new coal-fired plant. It's going to burn a low-grade coal called lignite. And they built the plant literally on top of a bed of lignite, a huge bed of lignite. And what they're doing is they're removing the carbon from that lignite as part of the process. Then they're taking that carbon dioxide as a gas, piping it 90 miles to an oil field to the south, where it is then injected into an aging oil field. And you think of it like this, Mary Charlotte. Have you ever had a Coke and out of a bottle, and after a few minutes it loses its pressure and the carbonization, it kind of goes flat? Oil fields do that. They have a natural pressure to them, and they can have 20, 30, as much as 40% of the oil sitting in the bottom of that well, and you can't get it out because it's lost its pressure. They use this carbon dioxide to shoot it back down in those old wells and get more oil out of them. So then the carbon dioxide stays underground in that bedrock where the oil had been. And so you've sequestered it in that way. This project is going to work. It's going to be one of the cleanest coal-fired plants probably in the world. And it's going to be producing energy but keeping that carbon out of the atmosphere. It's a good example of exactly what you're talking about with carbon sequestration, Mary Charlotte.
Another part of the Paris climate talks, which are very important, are the promises of substantial investment. What kinds of investment are we looking at? Where is the money coming from? Where is it going?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you're right. That's huge. In fact, John Kerry, Secretary of State, gave a keynote address during the Paris talks in which he said we need a complete transformation of the global economy away from the dirty fossil fuels that are driving climate change and toward cleaner, smarter ways to power our future without imperiling the planet. And that's what this investment is all about writ large. Secretary Kerry estimated that we're going to invest globally $50 trillion in the energy sector over just the next two decades. That's a huge amount of money. It's going to be a huge amount of jobs. And it's important that the preponderance of that investment be directed toward cleaner, smarter ways to power our future. So we're going to see a lot of wind and solar investment. China right now, in the past 5 years, China has been the largest investor in wind and solar power anywhere in the world. 40% of all the global wind and solar investment in the past 5 years has gone into China, $90 billion in 2014 alone. So this is huge. And we're making that kind of investment in our country as well, and we can talk about that. But the important thing is this is going to be coming from both private sector as well as public sector. And the developing countries, of course, need help in transitioning to this clean energy future. And the developed countries of the world have promised to create by 2020 a green fund of $100 billion a year in investment that will help these developing countries to do two things. One, build cleaner energy options like wind and solar. And two, deal with the consequences of climate change, help make these countries more resilient, help protect their people who are living on the front lines in many cases of the environmental degradation associated with climate change. So that's very important.
I mean, I think it is important, and this was a topic of discussion on programs like Democracy Now! During the talks, namely the role of rich versus poor countries, given that a lot of the poorest nations contribute the least to climate disruption and suffer the most. You know, it's kind of like we're having a big party, then we're dumping all our trash in the neighbor's driveway the next day. They weren't invited to the party. They're expected to clean up the mess. I mean, what did it feel like? How was that discussion going on, if it was, in Paris?
Yes, it was, and that's a good analogy that you use, Mary Charlotte, about the party that we're not invited to. And I do think that the developed countries, and certainly the United States, understands there is an inequity here that's being imposed upon these developing nations that we have to accommodate somehow. And the way it played out in Paris was fascinating because, you know, in Paris you had, it was a neighborhood just north, a suburb just north of Paris is where these talks took place. And there was a large venue there, and it was open to the public. The NGO community had a venue right next door to the venue where the negotiations were going on. And what we saw there was an amazing array of demonstrations of just how these climate impacts are affecting developing countries. For example, one day some artists brought in on a palanquin a melting ice sculpture that was supposed to resemble the Andean glaciers that are melting. And you had the Peruvian environmental minister there explaining to all of us who gathered around to look at this sculpture, this is a real problem because the glaciers of the Andes are the freshwater source for the entire region, for irrigation, for drinking water, for farming, for forest. And when those glaciers melt, there's nothing coming back to replace them. We've got to save those glaciers. We had people from Tibet coming in with some people in costume dressed like a yak, and it was, you know, save our yak. And that was emblematic of the devastation that's being visited upon that region. And so you had all of these kind of regional voices, Mary Charlotte, pointing out how climate change is impacting their regions, their lives, their future. And that was very important, very poignant, very much a part of the conversation. And the United States right now is providing about $430 million a year in public funding to help out developing countries. And what Secretary Kerry said in Paris was that we're going to double that to nearly $900 billion by 2020. That's our way of kicking in public funding for this global green fund. And, of course, private investment is huge as well, and we can talk about that if you'd like.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Private investment. Who is investing? What are they investing in?
Well, it's huge, and we've had a couple of things. First of all, in our country alone, a lot of people don't realize this, 57% of all the new electric generating capacity in this country in the first 10 months of this year came from wind and solar. 57%, almost 60% of all of our new electric generating capacity in this country is coming from the wind and the sun. And these are power company executives making these decisions. It's not something that's being imposed on anybody. They're looking around and saying, you know, dollar for dollar, this is a better bet to get power from the wind and the sun for the future than it is to invest in some of these dirtier energy sources. So that's a huge investment right here in this country that's going to change our future. It's changing the map of our power sources. Globally, we're having companies that have pledged to invest in clean energy. For example, Goldman Sachs, the Bank of America, Citigroup, those three companies together have pledged to invest a total of $325 billion at least in clean energy just in the coming decade. And that, of course, would be at home and abroad. We've also seen large multinational corporations in the United States, companies like General Motors, Walmart, Google, Apple Computers. These companies are all pledging to do a couple of things. One, to clean up their own house, reduce their own carbon footprint. And two, to continue to invest in clean energy where they operate. So this is making a huge difference as well.
We're talking to Bob Deans of the Natural Resources Defense Council. In the past, there's been a lot of capital for this kind of investment that hasn't been invested because there wasn't a consistent and reliable regulatory environment that made investment possible, as there kind of is in other countries. Where do we stand on that now, and what's your position as an organization? What would constitute a strong regulatory framework in which investment in clean energy would really work?
Well, let's start with the United States and then move globally. In the United States, what we need to do ultimately is send a clear market signal that we are paying a high price and a growing price for fossil fuel consumption and for the carbon pollution that results from that. And so at some point, people talk about some way of putting a price on carbon, because let's face it, Mary Charlotte, we are already paying the price. We're just not paying it in a rational way. That price is being imposed on ranchers in Colorado who are seeing their pastures blistered to chalk during record drought. It's being paid by corn farmers in Kansas who are experiencing the loss of their underground aquifers because they're having to irrigate crops so much more than they did just a generation ago. It's being experienced in Alaska, where glaciers are melting. It's being experienced all over our country and all over the world. And so rather than paying that price willy-nilly, we need to rationalize the price somehow so that we connect the external cost of fossil fuel consumption to the actual use of it in a way that ultimately deters that use and promotes cleaner, smarter options. So that's number one. And here's how we're doing it. President Obama has worked with automakers to produce a goal of doubling our gas mileage for our cars to 54.5 miles per gallon for new cars by 2025. That basically cuts our carbon footprint per mile driven in half. That's important. He's doing something similar with the big trucks that move most of our freight around this country. And most importantly, he is doing the same thing with the power plants that make up 40% of our carbon footprint. You know, we control the amount of pollution that comes out of these power plants in the way of nitrogen and sulfur and arsenic and mercury. We control these chemicals, but we've never put any kind of limit on the amount of carbon pollution that can come just gorging out of these smokestacks. And so for the first time ever, the president, through his clean power plan, is putting in place common sense standards that are going to put limits on that carbon pollution. That sends a clear signal to the markets. It's time to be shifting toward cleaner, smarter ways to power our future. So that's what's happening domestically. It's very important that we get this right. Globally, when those 187 countries all said, we're all going to put in place our own plans for reducing our reliance on fossil fuels, they sent a clear message to the market that the future is going to belong to those investors who recognize we have cleaner, smarter ways to power our future. That means more wind and solar. It means better grid technology so that we can accommodate these new energy sources. It means more electric cars. It means more high-speed rail. It means more mass transit options and bikeways and pedestrian walkways so people don't need their cars quite so much. And it means, of course, investing in efficiency so that we can do more with less. And here's great news. We have cut in this country, Mary Charlotte, in just the past 35 years, we have cut the amount of energy we use per dollar of economic output by 60%. That might have sounded confusing. We're using less than half of the energy per dollar output in this country than we did just 35 years ago. Just think what we can do if we build on the success of those policies with even better policies in the next couple of decades. We can change this situation.
Were fossil fuel companies, were oil and gas and coal companies at the talks?
You know, I'm sure they did have representatives. I didn't encounter any. I didn't hear a whole lot about it. But these companies, some of them, you've got a little bit of a mixed bag. There are a lot of utilities in this country that are welcoming the Clean Power Plan, for example. They're saying, you know, we need the certainty that you talked about of a regulatory framework that gives us a clear signal, and then we can hit the targets. We'll figure out the most cost-effective ways to hit the targets. But there are other companies, as you know, that are doing everything they possibly can to block the progress we need. That's something that we need, that we continue to see as a challenge. And again, if you want to go into it, we can talk about it.
Well, yeah, I'd like to talk about it because, I mean, the fossil fuel companies in this country have been responsible for so much greenwashing, obfuscation, denial, and basically have put millions or billions of dollars into steering the public discourse into what amounts to essentially a pack of lies. One would think that they would be diversifying into other energy sources. Do you see that?
You would think that, and it's sort of astounding that they haven't, but the reason they haven't is because there is so much profit to be made in the old way of doing things. And, of course, we are the ones who are driving the demand. You know, we here in this country use every single day, Mary Charlotte, 800 million gallons of oil. That's enough oil to fill the Empire State Building three times. In other words, if the Empire State Building were our national fuel tank, we'd be pulling over to refuel every 8 hours, which is a kind of an astounding figure. Turns out that getting that much oil out of the ground and selling it is a very profitable enterprise, a very lucrative enterprise. In fact, as of about 2 years ago, we were spending 8 cents of every dollar in this country on fossil fuels, coal, gas, and oil. I expect the number is very similar now, although with oil prices having come down, it may be slightly lower. But that gives you a sense of the magnitude of the stakes involved here for these fossil fuel companies. And what they've done is they have said there is one party in this country that we can count on to stand up for our interest. And in the last congressional midterm elections, not even a presidential election, the midterm congressional elections, the fossil fuel industry spent more than $720 million supporting its allies and agenda in Congress alone, never mind what they're doing at the state level. And what these people have been doing, the Republican leadership in Congress, doing everything they can to stop us from the progress that we need against climate change. They don't want us cleaning up our dirty power plants. They don't want us getting more mileage from our cars. They don't want us getting better fuel efficiency from our trucks. And they have done everything they can to stop us from this kind of progress. And so that's what we're up against. Until the fossil fuel industry comes around and recognizes that the real opportunity is going to be in the clean energy options of tomorrow and move away from the dirty fuels of the past, this is going to be the political situation. What we need to do as people is to stand up and talk about what's best for the rest of us. And we know from polling nationally and in key states around the country, about 7 out of 10 Americans understand we've got a problem. We need to deal with it urgently, and we have an obligation to protect our children from the growing dangers of climate change. That's about 70% of the public. But when you've got one single industry that holds a party captive with that kind of money, that's the political split that we have, and that is the political disconnect right now in this country that is preventing us from moving forward at the pace we really need to be moving.
We're talking to Bob Deans of the Natural Resources Defense Council. The profit of coal, oil, and gas would not be nearly as high if the cost, the external cost that you were talking about before, were included and were the responsibility of the people who were selling it to us. So in other words, if coal plants had to pay health care bills of the people who were contracting respiratory diseases or the cleanup of the air and water pollution, things like that, the profit would go way, way down. Is there a way to build those costs into the system and make them the responsibility of the producer?
There certainly is a way to do it. Any second-year economics student in the country could show you on a single piece of paper how to do that. The political will is the problem, and the huge stakes that the fossil fuel industry has in continuing to externalize those costs. And here's what we're talking about. Exploding oil trains in Lynchburg, Virginia, which is hundreds of miles away from the oil patch. Pipelines blowing up and polluting the Missouri River, again, far from the oil patch, but feeling the blow. An oil blowout in the Gulf of Mexico that puts millions of gallons of crude oil into some of the most fertile fishing waters anywhere in the world. As you mentioned, health problems. The increase in asthma attacks from more ozone in the air, from greater heat as a result of climate change, heart disease, respiratory ailments, on and on. These costs run well into the scores of billions of dollars a year when you begin to tally them all up. And who's paying these costs? The public is paying them, not the companies, not the consumers, the public. And in many cases, this is the same people who are decrying big government are coming in for government money to pay for the cleanup or to pay for the health costs that are involved in this. And so if you were to incorporate these external costs into the price of, for example, a gallon of gasoline, we would discover that gasoline is not cheap at any price. And so that's one of the things that we try to keep out there when gasoline prices go up or when, whether they go down or up, is that we're being all, our families, our economy, our corporations, our entire future is being held hostage to the price of a commodity that is priced on a global market we can neither control nor predict. And when you add those, that kind of whipsaw effect in with the constant external cost, you have to understand, we all understand, that oil is not cheap at any price.
We're talking to Bob Deans of the Natural Resources Defense Council about the Paris climate talks and what we have to look forward to in the next year, in the coming years. Now, this was, along with everything else, a real phenomenon in international relationships. It was sponsored, I guess, by the UN. And a lot of agreements were made. They're voluntary agreements. For example, countries take inventory of their carbon pollution. They share that information. How will they do that? How will anybody know whether the numbers are accurate? Are there standards? Are there technical assistance procedures and enforcement for all of this?
Yeah, great question, Mary Charlotte. In terms of enforcement, look, nobody's going to jail. I mean, there's not some international tribunal that's going to oversee this. But here's what we know, is that in international relations, credibility is the coin of the realm. And the way you build credibility in the international community is by doing what you say you're going to do. And so that's very important. That's a self-enforcing mechanism that's built into this process. All these countries agreed to come back again in 2020 and say, okay, here's where we said we were going, here's where we are now, and here's where we need to get to tomorrow. Nobody wants to be sitting at that table with their head in their hands going, yeah, actually, I didn't do what I told you I was going to do. Every country wants to be out there saying, you know what, we've actually beaten our target. How about you? What have you done? Right? That's the nature of international relations. And so what you're going to have, you do have international standards for how these carbon inventories are taken. And by the way, the inventories themselves are tremendously important. We've never had a global inventory of where this carbon pollution is coming from. And like anything else, we have to know where the pollution's coming from before we know how we can go out and get it. So that's very important to the individual countries, and it's very important globally. The second thing is that the countries, as they monitor these carbon emissions, they're subject to international standards for these monitoring, expert review by impartial scientists and researchers from around the world. And so this is going to help countries. You know, earlier this year, China admitted that it was actually producing about 17% more carbon pollution than it had believed it was prior to that time. And a lot of people said, oh boy, there you go. But here's the truth. The truth is that as China, for its own purposes, gets more serious about monitoring these emissions, it is getting better at doing so. And as it gets better, it gets more accurate information. And then it came forth and said, here's what we're finding out, here's what we're discovering. So as we help each other in the global community, as scientists help each other improve our monitoring, all of this gets better, all of it gets more accurate. That enables us to track it with better precision and to stay on top of each other, kind of hold our feet to the fire and keep each other accountable for our promises.
One of the things that we haven't talked about is energy storage, and that is an incredibly important component of making solar and wind really viable as complete energy sources. Solar and wind, as everybody knows, are not reliable. You can't tell the wind when to blow, the day is the length that it's going to be. What do you do when it's not windy or at night or in the winter when there's not as much sun and you need just as much or more energy as in the sunny and windy times? Energy storage is a huge part of our energy future. Was that part of the conversation?
Absolutely, and it is, you're right, it's a huge part of the conversation. Of course, when we think of storage, the first thing we go to is batteries and battery technology. And so that's been improving dramatically as with research and development, which is why we now have cars that can get up to 200 miles on a electrical charge because of the battery technology is improving. And what we know is that, for example, General Motors has invested scores of millions of dollars in new battery plants just outside of Detroit, so that they're looking at making a car that will sell for $40,000 that's going to be an affordable all-electric car that can get you up to 200 miles on a single charge. So that's why that storage component is so important. But when you look at it, as you said, in a more holistic way, for example, we're getting a lot of wind power in Iowa. How do we store that power, and how do we distribute it and so forth? We're looking at all kinds of different ways. I've heard Bill Gates talk about, you know, the idea, for example, instead of a battery, do we, in essence, during a sunny day when we're producing a lot of solar power, for example, do we use that excess electricity to pump water up into a tower so that at night when the sun goes down, that water can come down and drive a turbine using the force of gravity? Do we melt salt and then use the heat from that molten salt to drive power machinery when we're in the off hours? So there are all these other kinds of alternative storage technologies being looked at. And here's what's important. The United States, France, and 17 other countries that together account for about 80% of all the research and development in clean energy technologies like batteries and alternative storage systems, pledged to double their R&D investment over the next 5 years. And then Bill Gates gets together with Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, and about two dozen other billionaire investors to say, we're going to put together an investment fund that is going to help take the best ideas that come out of this research and development program and bring them to market where they can be tested and scaled up and actually put into use in our daily lives. When you get that kind of combination of the global leaders in research and development partnering with the global leaders in entrepreneurship, boy, that is a very powerful combination. That's going to change the whole field for new ideas in energy storage and related fields.
You talked earlier about the role of corporations in doing their share to mitigate climate change. In the past, I mean, a lot of corporations have just ignored climate change or really obfuscated their role. What does it look like right now? And who are the leaders in terms of large corporations?
Well, one way to gauge that is, of course, by what you're seeing on the ground. You know, General Electric has been very active in wind turbines. General Motors has been out there in helping us to put more all-electric cars on the road that are produced right here in this country. And, of course, Walmart has done its part in a lot of ways, sort of saving those swamps of down in Louisiana by refusing to buy hardwood mulch that comes from those cypress trees, that kind of thing. So you've had these kind of leaders. But you've also had there's been an interesting initiative the White House has put together that is kind of a can't remember the exact name of the initiative, but it's they've got about 150 major corporations, and some of those that I named, but also others, Coca-Cola, Bank of America, and others. But there are more than 150 companies, corporations in this country that have pledged to do their part to help fight climate change by cleaning up their own act, reducing their own carbon footprint. Coca-Cola has pledged to cut the carbon footprint of a Coke something like 25% over the next 5 to 10 years. You know, that's important. It's going to make a big difference because we drink a lot of Coke in this country. And so you've had 150 major corporations stepping up and saying, we're going to reduce our carbon footprint, and we're going to invest in clean energy, and we're going to strike a blow against climate change. That's important, and it's a growing building phenomenon, not only because countries want the public relations piece of it, because they understand it's better when a company becomes more efficient, when a company cuts its own energy cost, its workers, its products become more competitive in this increasingly competitive global marketplace of ours. We now have a global contest, Mary Charlotte, about which nation or group of nations are going to thrive in this clean energy future that we're talking about, with trillions of dollars and millions of jobs at stake. And so this is a very real competition that's going on at the corporate and national levels.
It's interesting because when you're talking, I'm sort of getting the sense that now it's, I don't want to say trendy, but now it's like the thing to do is to cut carbon emissions, and it's almost like everybody wants to kind of get in on the action, whereas 5, 10, 15 years ago when it was really urgent to do it, nobody was really doing it. Everybody was looking at everybody else saying, well, they're not doing it. Why should we? It's sort of like, I guess that's what we wanted. A cultural shift has taken place.
Part of this is generational, Mary Charlotte. You know, it's hard to find somebody under the age of 35 who is going to disagree with you about climate change. They say, yeah, of course it's happening. When are we going to get moving here? You know, they're, and so it's part of it's generational, but I think three things have come together. Number one, we have a president who understands the stakes for our future. He's talked about this so many times, and he's taken real action that we've described to protect future generations against the dangers of climate change. And he's a dad. This is personal for him. So we've got a president who understands the stakes. We've got this new generation who understand the urgency. They're not sitting here debating, gee, what if this? They're saying, no, we've got to get moving, and we've got to get moving now. And finally, we've got this growing web of business leaders, executives, investors around the country who understand the opportunity. They're looking around and they're going, you know, we've got 250,000 Americans who go to work every day helping us get more power from the wind and sun. That's three times as many people as we have working in the coal mine. So that's pretty important. All these jobs are important. But these are the jobs of the future, and these are the investments of the future, because investment is about the future. It's about the confidence we have. It's about the new direction we want to go in. It's about the kind of world we want to create. And so as investors look at a 5, 10, 15, 20-year horizon for return on their investment, when they're looking at where do we put our money, they're looking more and more at these clean energy sources, and they're moving more and more away from the dirty fossil fuels of the past. That's an important change medium right now.
And presumably it is good for their bottom line if their energy costs are reduced.
Certainly is. Reducing energy costs is a huge part of global competitiveness right now, which is why that number that we've got, reducing energy 60% as a part of our economic output over just the past 35 years, has been so vital to keeping this country competitive. Because remember, it's not only labor cost. You know, you look at the competition we have from low labor countries, that's a big part of it. But that's only one part of the cost. Energy costs are a huge component of any kind of manufacturing or even service provider. And so when you cut those energy costs, that's money that's going right to the bottom line.
You know, when you were talking about Coca-Cola reducing the carbon footprint of producing a can of Coke, I mean, the next step is not to drink Coke at all, because the carbon footprint that is involved, first of all, it's bad for you, but also the carbon footprint that's involved, as we learned from Michael Pollan, in producing that corn. I mean, corn has a huge carbon footprint, and therefore the corn syrup, which is the major component of Coke, is also really carbon intensive compared to drinking much healthier drinks.
It's such a big part of our lives and such a big part of our future, Mary Charlotte. And of course, we talk a lot about the electric power segment, our transportation segment, but the way we eat and consume clothing, those two pieces are an enormous part of the global carbon footprint. And more people are beginning to realize certain types of foods that are harmful to the environment need to be thought of as a minimum luxury items that we're going to have less and less of, and if not, items that we just can't do without anymore. And if you look at what's happening to our oceans right now, there's a direct connection between climate change and the health of our oceans in several ways. Number one, as oceans are warming, the entire biosystem globally is shifting. And oceans are warming enormously as a result of climate change. And some of these horrendous storms we've seen off the coast of Mexico, Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, the horrible typhoon that hit the Philippines a couple years ago. In each of these cases, you had a storm that lingered for several days over water that was 3, 4, 5 degrees warmer than the long-term average. And to heat an ocean by 3 or 4 or 5 degrees takes an enormous amount of energy, and it is exacting a lot of change in the ocean. The additional piece is that as we put carbon pollution in the air, a huge amount of that settles down in our ocean. And as it does, this pollution from burning fossil fuels has actually raised the acidity levels of the world's oceans in ways that we're beginning to see showing detrimental impacts on wildlife. It shows up first in coral and shellfish, but these are base level pieces of the food chain. When coral dies, all the small the organisms that depend on that coral die. And then what happens to the fish that feed on those organisms? They go away as well. And so we're seeing coral reefs beginning to die. We're seeing in places like the Pacific Northwest, we're seeing shellfish showing up with thin shells that they can't survive with because of this rising acidification. This connection between what's happening in the life of the oceans and what's happening to climate change is a huge threat to our children's future. We've got to do something about it.
We're talking to Bob Deans of the Natural Resources Defense Council. One thing that we haven't talked about yet is population control, contraception, education of girls as part of the bigger picture of resource consumption, energy use, and ultimately carbon output. Was that a conversation at the Paris Climate Talks?
I'm not sure about that because, you know, population control gets into some areas that become controversial in their own right, and so I'm not aware of that. I'm not going to say it wasn't, but I'm not aware if it was. And but here's what we do know without question. Whatever happens to global population, the key is what happens with consumption. And as population increases, people certainly want to improve the quality of their lives, and the question is, how do we best do that? And so at the NRDC, we have an office in China. We're working in India as well. And one of the things that we've done in India is in the deserts of Gujarat, where there is a lot of salt production out there, we have worked with at the village level. And it turns out that the women, oftentimes the moms and little girls, are the ones who are doing a lot of this work in helping to evaporate water and make salt. And what they've traditionally used, Mary Charlotte, are these diesel-powered pumps that help remove water from a salt bed. We have been helping them to replace those with solar-powered pumps. And the women are beginning to tell us, I'm saving enough money by not having to buy diesel fuel that for the first time I can send my children to school. This is huge. A girl who used to have to, at age 12, go to work literally in the salt mines is now getting to go to school and getting an education because her mom is saving enough on not having to spend that money on diesel fuel that she can now use it to pay for education for that child. It's going to change the future for the people of India. And as you just said, there's a direct correlation between education and population. A young girl who grows up with an education, with a career, is going to have a different population arc, if you will, than those who are raised simply to be used as units of labor.
Do you see climate being a real issue in the 2016 presidential elections and overall elections here in the U.S.?
No question about it. And let's just go back to the 2012 elections. We had the clearest choice ever on climate change between two candidates. We had one candidate who said, this is a serious issue, we need to do something about it. We had another candidate who said, it's a joke. And we went with the guy who said it's a problem. That's what we said in Virginia. That's what we said in Colorado. That's what we said in Ohio and in Pennsylvania. Across this nation, we said, we need a president who understands the stakes for our future and our obligation to our children. And there's no question, in 2016, we are not going to elect a candidate who doesn't understand the stakes for our country and for our children's future in doing something about climate change. That the next president has to understand that, and I don't think there's any question but that voters are going to demand it.
It has barely surfaced as an issue. I mean, it's been completely a non-issue in Republican debates and really not much of an issue in Democratic debates so far.
You know, it's interesting because I think that demonstrates a couple of things. I don't think Democrats are debating climate change anymore. If you look at the polling on people who self-identify as Democrats, you get numbers way up into, you know, into the upper 80s and even the 90% of people saying this is a problem and we need to do something about it. The Republican Party, you will still get majorities of people who self-identify as Republicans. Majorities of these people are saying it's a problem and we do need to do something about it. The missing link is what you and I discussed before, the hundreds of millions of dollars that the fossil fuel industry is pumping into, primarily about 90% of that money is going toward Republican candidates. And so you have this disconnect between what the voters want and what these candidates are out there going to bat for. And let me just give you a quick example of how this plays out, where the rubber meets the road. A year ago, we had, for the first time in many years, Republican control of the Senate and the House. And what was the very first issue they came out of the gate on? Do you remember? It was the Keystone XL Dirty Tar Sands Pipeline. And no matter how you feel about the pipeline, here's a country that's facing serious issues, whether it's income inequality, tax fairness, the problem with ISIS, the larger problems of Syria and the Middle East. We could go on and on. But what was the first thing, the very first vote? These guys couldn't wait to cast a vote to build a dirty tar sands pipeline. That was number one on their agenda. That tells you quite a bit. What did they just go to bat for in this huge omnibus spending bill, the budget negotiations that we had that nearly closed the government down in December? What was their sticking point? They were demanding that we lift the oil, the crude oil export ban, which is a gift to big oil. That was what the Republican leaders were going to the mat on. They were willing to close the government, to shut down our entire government over that issue. That tells you the stranglehold that the fossil fuel industry has on this party, and that's why we have this massive disconnect between what the American people want and what the candidates of this party are talking about.
We've got a few minutes left, and I wanted to wrap up by asking you, how effective do you think are the lower emissions targets that were discussed in Paris? I mean, we've agreed, I think it was to cut emissions by about a quarter compared to 2005, but we were emitting an awful lot of carbon in 2005. Are these targets enough?
They are not enough, but they are an essential start. And let's talk about it. Since the Industrial Revolution, but mostly, Mary Charlotte, in the last 50 to 60 years, average global temperatures have increased by about 1 degree centigrade. Scientists agree that a two degree centigrade increase is as high as we can conceivably go without triggering the very worst effects of climate change. So we've got to hold that down. The targets that were articulated in Paris will get us about halfway where we need to go. They won't get us to that 2 degree mark. We're on track to go to way overshoot that, and even with these targets, we're going to overshoot it. So, but what we have done is we've begun to turn a big ship around. We've begun to say, you know what, there are limits to what we can do with fossil fuels. We need to begin scaling back. And here's the context for it. Last June, President Obama and his G7 partners pledged to phase out all fossil fuel consumption by the end of this century. That is huge. September, the Pope comes from the Vatican to remind us of our moral obligation to protect our children from the growing dangers of climate change. Huge impact. November, President Obama rejects the Keystone XL Dirty Tar Sand Pipeline, saying we just can't afford the increased danger and risk to our climate. And finally, in December, 187 countries get together and say we have got to turn away from these fossil fuels that are driving climate change and figure out cleaner, smarter ways to power our future without threatening our kids. You put that all together. Mary Charlotte, it may be too early to say we're looking at the twilight of the fossil fuel age, but we certainly are seeing the sun beginning to set. We're beginning to see a world that at last moves away from wholly reliant on these fuels. We'll be burning them for years to come, but we're going to be moving away from that. And you can see long-term the vision that's been articulated by these leaders. Long-term, cleaner, smarter ways to power our future and protect our climate.
Bob Deans is Director of Strategic Engagement with the Natural Resources Defense Council in Washington, D.C. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great to be with you, Mary Charlotte. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.